content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the science section of the May issue and is entitled A Flash of Recognition in a Lonely Universe. Beyond our solar system, the universe is full of planets, but also asteroids, auroras, and other familiar cosmic wonders. And this article is by Marina Corin. Several centuries ago, as scientists began to embrace the startling idea that Earth was not the center of the universe, they also began to ponder its startling implication, that the stars in the night sky might be suns in their own right, orbited by their own worlds. Until the 1990s, that idea was no more than a hypothesis. By then, telescopes had become sufficiently advanced to reveal the hard evidence. A star about 50 light years away was wobbling, a sign that a small world was tugging on it. This world was called an exoplanet. Astronomers have since discovered more than 5,300 exoplanets and counting, and they're studying the atmosphere of these worlds to determine if the molecules suspended in their clouds could sustain life. They've even recently captured evidence of an exoplanet getting swallowed up by its dying star. Truly, telescopes have gotten really good. Although most people probably can't name an exoplanet, something like HD 108236b doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. The fact is, the cosmos is full of them, is now well known. The exo prefix extends beyond the realm of planets. Astronomers have found exo-auroras, exo-asteroid belts, and even exo-rings, such as the ones that surround Saturn. Exo-moons haven't been proved to exist, but astronomers believe that they are more numerous than the exoplanets themselves. The search for such celestial objects and structures has intensified in recent years. Just this week, astronomers announced that they had found an exo-radiation belt, an invisible cocoon of charged particles held in place by the planet's magnetic field. We are firmly in the era of exo-things. There is plenty of scientific possibility in the discovery of exo-things, but also comfort. Not to be dramatic, but Earth is a small island in an endless sea. Ours is a cosmically lonely existence. So it's nice to look out across that sea, dark and unknowable, and occasionally spot other islands, other familiar shores. The study of exo-things is a way of conversing with the rest of the cosmos and saying, oh, you've got one of those too. And because any hypothetical life must live somewhere, exo-things could someday answer one of our most existential questions. Are we alone? When Melody K.O., an astronomer at UC Santa Cruz, went looking for exo-things, she set her sights 20 light-years away on a brown dwarf, a rather unusual object that is neither a star nor a planet, with a mass somewhere in between the two. K.O. had previously studied this particular brown dwarf and found that its intense radio emissions produced auroras similar to our own northern lights. She couldn't account for what was causing the aurora, so she turned to our own solar system for inspiration and realized that planets with auroras also have radiation belts. No one had ever found one outside the solar system before, but when K.O. went looking for one around her brown dwarf, voila, there it was, a radiation belt, invisible to the human eye, but billowing in radio wavelengths in all its exo-glory. Exo-asteroid belts are downright stunning, particularly in infrared wavelengths. Astronomers recently used the most powerful observatory in operation, the James Webb Space Telescope, to observe a star about 25 light-years away with a known asteroid belt. They were surprised to find not one single ring of material, but three. The dusty region was likely shaped by the same forces that produced these versions in our own solar system, the movement of the planets hidden somewhere in those concentric rings. It's sort of comforting that the same processes likely play out, to some extent, very similarly. Andras Gaspar, an astronomer at the University of Arizona who led the observations, told me. Perhaps, he added, we're not the only ones who are deciphering how our universe works. Although the universe is full of repeats, each iteration brings its own little quirks. The exoradiation belt that Kao discovered, for example, is almost 10 million times more intense than Earth's, Kao said. The exo-asteroid belt is far more complex than our main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, as well as the Kuiper belt further out, a region beyond Neptune of icy objects and dust. And the only known set of exo-rings is 200 times larger than Saturn's, possibly because it sits around a young sun-like star, not a planet. Some exo-things have proved elusive, even though astronomers would bet all the money in the universe that they exist. Exomoons are one of them. Our solar system is full of moons, so others must be too, but no one's been able to prove they exist. In 2018, a pair of astronomers said they had found evidence of what could be the first known exomoon, orbiting a planet around a star 8,000 light years from here. But when other teams took up the same data and conducted their own analyses, they got mixed results. So the search continues. It continues as well for the most elusive exo-thing, a truly Earth-like planet, nice and rocky, with a chemically rich atmosphere and temperatures that would allow water to lap on us the surface. Mansi Kaliswal, an astronomy professor at Caltech who was involved in the discovery of the unfortunate exoplanet consumed by its star, told me she thinks a lot about the idea of an exo-home. Not another place in the universe where humans might relocate, though she hopes future generations take a crack at that before our own sun swallows our own planet in a few billion years. But some other speck out there where life managed to emerge and thrive. It doesn't even have to be identical to Earth, she said. It just needs to be habitable and hospitable, a planet that is home to some species. Our collection of exo-things, large and small, is growing every year. Until recently, I had a lot of exoplanet envy, said Jackie Villadson, a physics and astronomy professor at Bucknell University who worked with Kao. Now we can do extra radiation belts. Compared with exoplanets, which can have oceans of lava and raindrops made of glass, radiation belts might seem a little boring, but exo-things, whatever they are, lend themselves to daydreaming. Consider the exo-asteroid belt that Gaspar studies. The star at its center is about 440 million years old, much younger than our approximately 4.6 billion-year-old sun. When our sun was at that age, Earth was still lifeless. It's very doubtful that any life could have emerged, let alone sophisticated, intelligent life forms, Gaspar said. But maybe sometime in a cosmic future, a spark will flash. Someday, perhaps, a group of beings on a planet inside that system will dispatch little robots into the depths to the other planets and moons nearby. They will sprinkle signs of their existence beyond their cozy atmosphere, all the way out to their asteroid belt and beyond. After all, it happened here. Next, a book review by Jack Hamilton. Surrender to Steely Dan. How the insufferably perfectionist duo captured the hearts of a new generation of listeners. The first time I ever heard Steely Dan's music wasn't on a Steely Dan recording. It was in the mid-1990s, and I was in my early teens listening to a cassette of De La Soul's 3 Feet High and Rising, 1989, a hip-hop album that blew my young mind. I wanted to hear one track in particular, a love song called I Know, over and over again. It was so effervescent, so totally joyful. A few years later, I learned that I Know was constructed around a sample of Peg, the fourth track of Steely Dan's 1977 album Asia. Meanwhile, another Asia sample was making the rounds in hip-hop. The opening track, Black Cow, was the bedrock for Lord Tariq and Peter Guns' 1997 rap radio blockbuster, Deja Vu, Uptown Baby. Music obsessive that I was, this confounded me. Steely Dan, the musical handle of the songwriting pair Walter Becker and Donald Fagen, was considered toxically uncool. Steely Dan was also in the midst of a decades-long hiatus from releasing new studio albums. After putting out seven from 1972 to 1980, I knew the band's 1974 hit Ricky Don't Lose That Number, a steady presence on classic rock radio, but I had trouble wrapping my head and ears around it. The guy singing in a plaintive nasal voice seemed pretty sure that Ricky was, in fact, going to lose that number. Every time he sang, and you could have a change of heart, a gnarled run of notes followed that sounded oddly aggressive. I recognized the bass piano line from Horace Silver's Bossa Nova Jazz Chestnut, Song for My Father, because I'd played it on my own jazz piano lessons. But what was it doing in a pop song? Ricky's strange combination of jazz, rock, and R&B, alchemized into a near-frictionless sonic slickness, seemed antithetical to the grunge-era ethos of the anti-establishment, hard-on-your-sleeve authenticity. In hindsight, Steely Dan's Zelig-like presence in the sample-based hip-hop looks like a harbinger of the band's current renaissance, a duo that was one of the most polarizing acts in rock, even at its peak in the 1970s, has lately acquired an army of new fans, many of them remarkably young. Listeners born well after the group made its best-known work are especially ardent as social media accounts with names like Good Steely Dan Takes and People Dancing to Steely Dan attest. Steely Dan memes steadily proliferate on Twitter and Instagram and among the massively popular R Steely Dan Reddit community. In 2019, the music publication Pitchfork, which had reviewed the band's 2000 comeback album, Two Against Nature, with Cooler Than Thou contempt and given it a score of 1.6 out of 10, published retrospective reviews of five of the band's most esteemed studio albums, all of them rated 8.3 or higher. The pop culture critic Alex Papademos, who wrote one of those Pitchfork reviews, dives into this danaissance in Quantum Criminals, Ramblers, Wild Gamblers, and Other Soul Survivors from the Songs of Steely Dan, a collection of illustrated essays dreamed up in collaboration with the artist Joan LeMay. The book doesn't aspire to be a history of the band's vicissitudes or a conventional march through its discography. Instead, Papademos offers a lively series of ruminations about individual songs, loosely pegged to the characters who populate those songs and who are rendered in playfully detailed and colorful portraits by LeMay. The result is both a celebration and an artifact of the current Steely Dan moment. Papademos tries out several theories to explain danaissance's timing. The most compelling of them is the idea that their songs, full of gallows humor and wry disillusionment, resonate with a generation raised on crashing economies and a climate crisis. Donald and Walter's songs of money decadence, druggy disconnection, slow-motion apocalypse, and self-destructive escapism seemed satirically extreme way back when. Now they seem prophetic, he writes. We are all Steely Dan characters now. The truth is, Steely Dan's trajectory has never been readily explicable. The band's success defied rock and roll logic at every turn, starting with the fact that it really wasn't a band. Steely Dan was the invention of two young men who had met at Bard College in the late 60s and were obsessed with Bob Dylan and Charlie Parker in equal measure. Shortly after leaving Bard, Fagen and Becker moved to Los Angeles to become in-house songwriters for ABC Dunhill Records. When their compositions proved too offbeat for other ABC artists to perform, the pair began to record the work themselves, with Fagan on keyboards and vocals, Becker on bass, and a roster of top-flight rock players rounding out the proceedings. ABC released Steely Dan's first album, Can't Buy a Thrill, in 1972. It sold 500,000 copies within weeks and spun off two hit singles, Do It Again and Reeling in the Years. If Can't Buy a Thrill had been the only album Steely Dan ever made, we would remember the band very differently. Fagan doesn't even sing lead on three of the album's tracks, and by Steely Dan's later standards, the music is almost shaggy, full of jangling guitars and earworm radio pop flourishes. It's steeped in folk rock, Beatlesque chord changes, and 60s vintage soul grooves. No other Steely Dan album feels quite so eager to be liked. When Fagan and Becker followed up a year later with Countdown to Ecstasy, their true sound took shape. Their second album is full of dazzling rhythms, sophisticated harmonic structures, lyrics that are spiky and evocative and seethe with mordant disaffection. Will you still have a song to sing when the Razor Boy comes and takes your fancy things away? Fagan croons on Razor Boy, so mellifluously that you can easily miss that he's singing about death. After Countdown, nearly every aspect of Fagan and Becker's project felt like a deliberate flouting of rock conventions. No sooner had 1974's Pretzel Logic, propelled by the popularity of Ricky Don't Lose That Number, became their biggest selling album yet, than Fagan and Becker decided to stop touring and reimagine Steely Dan as a purely studio-based entity. The duo proceeded to host a churn of crack session musicians summoned to perform at near impossible levels of exactitude, compositions that grew ever more ambitious and technically demanding. Working with the producer Gary Katz and the engineer Roger Nichols, Fagan and Becker were in pursuit of perfect tones, perfect textures, perfect sounds. Steely Dan released two more studio albums, K.D. Lied, 1975, and The Royal Scam, 1976, before Asia in 1977, and Gaucho 3 years later. And then Steely Dan didn't make another studio album for 20 years. Like jazz greats of earlier generations, Fagan and Becker composed music full of dense harmonic structures and intricate arrangements. They openly worshipped at the feet of those masters. The only cover they ever recorded was a reverently faithful rendition of Duke Ellington's 1926 classic East St. Louis Toodaloo, which appears on Pretzel Logic. They wrote surreal, scabriously witty songs about washed-up hipsters and failed threesomes, the incongruity of their buff to a shine sound adding to the humor. Their lyrics name-dropped a wide range of figures, among them the avant-garde mezzo-soprano Kathy Barbarian, the Queen of Soul Aretha Franklin, and Napoleon. They also wrote about unforgettably strange fictional figures who went by names like Thelonious, Kid Charlemagne, and Deacon Blues. In sharp and funny chapters, Papademos riffs on this cast of characters in ways that capture the band's cultural contents, text, and musical debts. An inspiration for Kid Charlemagne, for example, is the hippie Acid King Augustus Owensley Stanley III, the principal LSD chemist for the Merry Pranksters and the Grateful Dead, whose decline the song recounts. Alone without a community of revolutionaries around him, Papademos writes, he's now just another criminal on the run. Steely Dan's music posed a question. Was it possible to be ironist and perfectionist simultaneously? Was taking rock and roll this seriously an ultra-high-concept joke, or was the way to unlock the music's full creative potential? Or had Steely Dan somehow come up with the blend of both, a virtuistic balancing act of scathing satire and fervent earnestness? At one point, Papademos describes Fagan and Becker as cynical about their own cynicism, a phrase that hints at the fierce idealism that runs beneath the surface of even their iciest music. Such contradictions made Steely Dan an anomalous presence in the landscape of 70s rock. The band that wasn't really a band was devoid of phallic swagger of, say, Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith, While Bruce Springsteen was redefining heroic authenticity and gracing the covers of national magazines, Fagan and Becker retreated behind their retinue of characters. Steely Dan's ever-changing lineups deprived the band's public of the personality-driven soap operas that fans thrilled to in groups such as the Rolling Stones and Fleetwood Mac. The pair's refusal to tour stood out as arena rock became a massive business. Fagan and Becker never even appeared on one of their studio album covers. At a time when rock stardom was synonymous with being cool, the two of them seemed uninterested in being rock stars and completely indifferent to being cool. An old joke about Steely Dan's reliance on studio musicians has it that Fagan and Becker were writing music so difficult that they couldn't even play it themselves. This isn't true. Both were terrific instrumentalists and can be heard all over Asia. But still, the deployment of so many hired guns was one of the most controversial and misunderstood aspects of their endeavors. Detractors, viewing it as proof of prefab inauthenticity, disparaged Steely Dan as essentially a factory dedicated to turning out the world's most finely tuned musical product. But enlisting studio players, far from an abdication of artistic vision, was a fanatical assertion of Fagan and Becker's vision. The fantasy that rock and roll bands are democracies, melting pots of individual contributions and sensibilities, wholes greater than the sum of their parts, is deep-seated and attractive. By Asia, Steely Dan had dispensed with such notions, if their founders had ever embraced them. Fagan and Becker were the bosses and everyone else was an employee. To use a famous example, the pair reportedly brought in as many as 8 different guitarists to try playing the roughly 25-second guitar solo on Peg. From one angle, this looks like tyrannical micromanagement. From another, it looks like the sort of uncompromising rigor and sacrifice of time, money, and other people's individual talent in the service of a relentless aspiration that certain great art requires. In the case of Steely Dan, listeners can find themselves under unforgiving pressure, too. Insistent about making music entirely on their own terms, Fagan and Becker deliver a sound defined by calculating precision, one that offers little of the visceral thrill of impulsivity that many fans expect from rock music. It's a listening experience that some will find deeply alienating, others endlessly alluring. There are artists who don't work this way, Papademos writes, but none of them have made Peg, a song that he extols in terms that distill Steely Dan's aesthetic. It's 100 layers of carefully positioned to create the illusion of casual cohesion, the whole ecosystem arrayed in the shape as sleek as a surfboard. Decades ago, young hip-hop artists stumbled upon Steely Dan because of the band's popularity among slightly older generation of black listeners. De La Soul's Kelvin Mercer, also known as Posse Duos, has recalled first listening to Peg as a child with his father, years before the sample found its way onto 3 Feet High and Rising. Now, as a new generation of listeners discovers the band, the sonic and stylish polish of Steely Dan that seemed so divisive in the 70s and in the 90s is evidently no longer such a deterrent. Slick doesn't carry the sting that it used to. For those weary of the rockism versus poptimism debates of the past couple of decades, and who isn't, Steely Dan offers a welcome escape from the reductive opposition between rock as Promethean self-expression and pop as a big tent pleasure center. The band didn't mind being dismissed by most doctrinate rock partisans, soulless and by the calculated nature antithetical to what rock should be, as a Rolling Stone review of Asia summed up the brief against them. At the same time, Steely Dan's music is unapologetically snobbish, flouting the "everything is great" ethos of extreme poptimism. A band that charts an idiosyncratic path ends up acquiring an eclectic audience, this one united by a tenacious devotion to the work of a pair of artists who were themselves nothing if not devoted. When I became a full-fledged Steely Dan fan in my 20s, I found the depth of care and attention in Fagan and Becker's music deeply moving, even romantic. If the lyrics were often cynical, everything else felt like the opposite, and the tensions held in Steely Dan's sound spoke to, well, my soul. I'm glad to know that I have new company. Next, James Parker's Ode to Middle Age. From the outside, it looks steady. It looks resolved. Sitting heavily in a chair with settled opinions and stodgy shoes, there's something unbudgeable about the middle-aged person. The young are dewy and volatile, the older toppling into their fragility, but the middle-aged hold their ground. There's a kind of magnetism to this solidity, this doughty poise, this impressively median state. But on the inside, you're in deep flux, a second puberty, almost, inflammations, precarious accelerations, dysmorphic shock in the bathroom mirror. Jesus, who is that? Strange new acts of grooming are suddenly necessary. Maybe you've survived a bout with something serious. You probably have a couple of fussy little private afflictions. You need ointment. It feels like a character flaw. Maybe it is a character flaw. For all of this, though, you are weirdly and unwantonly calm, like someone riding a bicycle without using his hands. You're not an apprentice adult anymore. You're through the disorientation period, the talking heads moment, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here? You're through the angst and panic attacks. You don't yet have the wild license of old age, when you can write gnarly, scandalous poems. But you're more free. The stuff that used to obsess you, those grinding circular thoughts, they've worn themselves out. You know yourself quite well by now. Life has introduced you to your shadow. You've met your dark double, and with a bit of luck, the two of you have made your accommodations. You know your friends, you love your friends, and you tell them. I'm generalizing my own case, of course, but what else can I do? Besides, a sense of at last of having some things in common with other humans, those wobbling bipeds, this too is one of the gifts of middle age. Limits, limits, thank God for limits, thank God for the things you cannot do and that you know you cannot do. Thank God for the final limit, death, who now gazes at you lovely from the foot of your bed in an ironic twinkle because you still don't completely believe in him. At any rate, if you're reading this, you're not dead. So, you should leap gladly, grinningly, into the contradictory middle years when everything is speeding up and slowing down and becoming serious, more serious, and less serious. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.